Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Joey Krug. Joey is the co-founder of Augur, a decentralized prediction market platform, and the co-chief investment officer at Pantera Capital's crypto investment funds. Before joining Pantera, Joey built a point-of-sale system enabling Bitcoin payments with sound and Bluetooth, and he also started an AngelList syndicate, which is now one of the top 15 by backing. And now, to the interview. Hi, Joey, and many thanks for taking time today.
Thanks for having me.
Joey, you've been in the blockchain space for many years, and you founded companies, have advised companies, and invested. And I'd like to speak a little bit about your work as an investor first. So you said previously that you think healthcare, finance, energy, and government are the areas most ripe for disruption. So why do you think that?
Yeah, so I think... you know, if you look at those kind of four areas, you know, starting with finance, they all kind of have various problems. But the main problems with finance tend to be things like cost. It's expensive to do certain financial interactions. You know, banks and entities on Wall Street tend to be kind of intermediaries that sit in the middle and extract value from both sides of the transaction. And so I think, you know, there are definitely ways to do things more efficiently in that world. And the cool thing about finance is, you know, usually if you're doing something more efficient, it actually makes economic sense to do so. So it's relatively easy to get people to kind of migrate over to new solutions. If you look at, you know, like healthcare and government, I think those are both areas ripe for disruption, but they're much harder to get people to actually adopt new tech. So if you create something in healthcare, even if it's something that works, and even if you've proven that it works, you know, you've done rigorous studies, it doesn't always mean that you'll get people to be able to use it. you know, kind of an older example of this is when people figured out that H. pylori bacteria caused a lot of stomach ulcers. The doctor who found that out was basically ignored for, you know, years before people started to actually start treating the disease like that. And you kind of look back throughout the history of medicine, and it's kind of a similar pattern. So I think to disrupt healthcare, you know, you really have to think outside the box, and the difficult challenge is getting people to adopt things. But if you look at both healthcare and government, they're two kind of areas of the economy that the cost of things in those two areas has risen much faster than GDP or much faster than inflation. So they're much more expensive relative to other areas. And so to me, that means that they're areas ripe for disruption, because if you can make them more efficient and drop the cost down, you can have a more efficient solution that works just as well. And then the last area that I'm, you know, excited about as an investor is energy. Particularly, I'm excited about, you know, batteries. In the battery space, you know, we haven't really seen huge increases in like capacity for batteries since the lithium ion battery. We've seen people create larger batteries and safer batteries, and batteries that can, you know, run, that you can charge them and discharge them more and more times. But we haven't really seen that many increases in capacity for them. So I think that's something that I think somebody will make a breakthrough there over the next, you know, next few years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. You're also a co-chief investment officer at Pantera Capital. And that's a blockchain investment fund. And finance, that's a pretty easy bridge there between blockchain and finance. But what about healthcare, energy, and government?
Yeah, so I mean, the way I think about it is... yeah, I don't know where you found that quote, actually, because I said that, like, I've only said that a couple times.
But, I think it was on your angel list.
Oh, got it. But yeah, so the way I think about it is, you know, I think those other areas aren't necessarily quite ready to be disrupted yet. You know, I think right now we have a really good opportunity to disrupt the financial ecosystem, primarily because I think, you know, with the rise of blockchain tech, it'll enable a lot of cool innovations. I think on the, you know, healthcare and government side of things, I haven't done as much investing. I've invested, you know, angel invested in a few, AI healthcare startups. But I think on the healthcare side of things, I think tech like CRISPR and kind of bioengineering needs to mature a bit more. So that eventually, the way I kind of envision it is eventually, solving healthcare problems, I think will eventually sort of become similar to software problems in the sense that you're having to reprogram something or write a program to create something that solves some problem. And I think a lot of that will center around tech like CRISPR and other sorts of bioengineering technologies. But I think that's, you know, farther off in the future. So that's probably something I actually dive into more from an investor standpoint, you know, maybe a decade or two from now.
At Pantera, what do you look at when you assess investments for the fund?
Yeah, so, you know, most VCs, if you talk to them, they'll say, you know, the most important thing is team, and that is really true. When you're looking at a project, the team is really important because you're going to run into all sorts of unforeseen issues that you're going to have to persevere through when you're doing a startup. And so having a strong team with, you know, diverse expertises and diverse experiences is really important. Besides that, you know, one of the big things we look for is having kind of a technical roadmap or technical plan that's credible and makes sense. Obviously that roadmap's going to change quite a bit over time. But what we're primarily looking for there is, you know, can you at least write something that's, you know, makes sense at a high level kind of from day one? Because if you can't do that, you know, our confidence that you've been able to iterate on it is significantly lower. And then the other two kind of pieces that I think are really important are, you know, the product and the market. So what actually are you building? How large is the market that you're going after? And, you know, really, is it actually a kind of order of magnitude improvement over something that already exists? Or is it just kind of taking something from 10 to 11 is much less interesting than taking something kind of from 0 to 1.
Right.
So those are the sorts of things you think about.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say team, because you're right. I mean, almost every VC and investor says that. But then again, everybody has different ways of finding out, you know, if a team is good and works well together. So do you have any approaches, you know, to maybe gauge whether a team will be able to follow through on what they promise, or whether there, you know, some possible bottlenecks ahead, or how do you look at those teams?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's true. Everybody looks at a team differently. So like even how I look at a team is different than, you know, my partners look at a team.
Mm-hmm.
So where I start, you know, generally is on the technical side, just because it's faster for me to kind of analyze a team from a technical standpoint than it is for me to, you know, call up everybody they used to work with and do a bunch of reference checks. But I have partners who, you know, definitely do it the other way first. But for me, I look at kind of what they've done technically in the past, whether it's related to blockchain tech or not, whether they've worked on, you know, credible projects, whether they have, you know, code that I can see on GitHub. And then also, particularly in the blockchain space, you know, looking at kind of what they've published about their project and really seeing whether it makes sense from a technical standpoint. And kind of what I mean by that is, the simplest analogy here, I think, is, you know, in the blockchain space, we see a lot of projects that if you were a physicist, they're akin to pitching a physicist on the idea of, you know, we solved the problem of cold fusion. And that's something that many physicists consider might be actually impossible. Or if it is possible, you definitely would want to have, you know, thermodynamic experiments and really rigorous proof that you have actually solved the problem. You can't just walk up to a physicist and say, "Hey, I have a startup. It solves cold fusion. Do you want to invest?" You know, because it's something that you're going to be strongly doubted on. And so in the blockchain space, when we see projects that kind of, if they have like these kind of huge grand promises, that's usually a red flag. And then, you know, we always dig in deeper though, because there's the small chance that they actually do have a huge promise and they actually have the solution to deliver on it. But most of the time, if you look at these sort of, you know, innovations, people are doing things that are kind of much more reasonable. So an example of this would be, you know, there's tons of blockchain pitches we see where somebody says, "Oh, our tech can do a million transactions per second." And that's a huge red flag, because even Visa only does, you know, around 10,000 or so per second. And if you're doing more than Visa, and Visa is running on basically centralized infrastructure, you know, that kind of violates a lot of the basic kind of laws of physics and bandwidth issues. Now, if you come to us and say you're doing, you know, 1500 per second, you may actually have a solution, and we'll dig in farther and see whether we think that you have a solution that actually makes sense. But that's kind of how we approach it, is basically making sure that, so I think when you're investing in a founding team or a founder, you know, the most important thing besides just the team is kind of, you know, kind of personal characteristics. Like, you want the person to be honest and have integrity. And then you also want them to have kind of a lot of, you know, drive or zest to kind of do what they're trying to do. And for me, starting on the technical side is an easier way to suss that out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Yeah, I was just about to ask about more of the qualitative indicators. I mean, because what you mentioned previously was more quantitative, you know, on their technical skills. But what else do you think are those character traits that make good entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the kind of like, if I had to describe a good entrepreneur in like a couple of words, I think it'd be somebody who really combines both science and art. And that sounds kind of hand wavy, but I think it's actually really important, because you need somebody who's able to do things in a very kind of rigorous way. You need to have processes set up as a company to make sure that, you know, essentially the trains are running on time, so to speak. But you also need to be really creative, because if it was just a matter of, you know, nailing down some specific process, there would be no need for startups, because regular corporations would just solve all the problems. And that's obviously, you know, not the case. And I think part of the reason is because, you know, in order to actually create something new and innovative that actually adds value to the world, you need to be good at both kind of the scientific aspect of things, doing things in a rigorous way, but also really creative and, you know, thinking outside of the box, so to speak, and coming up with new solutions that other people haven't thought of.
Are there specific questions that you ask to look for creativity?
You know, I don't have any like specific questions. It's really just kind of, you know, going through like a conversation with the person, mm-hmm. and kind of figuring out how they think about problems. So, you know, some questions, I guess, that you could think of are like, you know, asking them, well, why hasn't someone tried to do this before? Or if somebody has tried to do this before, you know, and you're familiar with a bunch of startups that have failed in the past, ask them, you know, why do you think those startups failed? Why do you think this won't? What's different here? And, you know, sometimes it's as simple as just those other startups were too early. But other times, you know, a lot of the time, actually, they did something kind of very specific wrong. And, you know, whoever you're talking to, they may or may not have a new twist on it. And if they do, you know, that's generally a good sign that they're thinking about things, you know, differently.
I'd like to ask your opinion of the valuations of some of these projects, you know, in the blockchain space. I mean, I started a company when I was 21 and it was my first company. And I mean, it would have been almost a miracle if somebody had invested $100,000. You know, it would have been huge for me at that age. And now, I mean, if somebody does an ICO and raises $1 million, it seems like a failure. So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I think the valuations in this space are kind of pretty high, in my opinion. You know, I remember the Ethereum crowd sale, you know, they raised 20 million. And at the time, that was considered to be a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we see founders, you know, wanting to raise 50 million, 100 million. And, you know, for the most part, I think it's bad for a few reasons. One is just, you know, you really don't need that much money to execute on these sorts of ideas. And the cool part about this tech is it's all freely available. It's all open source. And it's really all just, it's really all kind of, if you're building a protocol anyway, it's really all just software. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to interface with the real world that much. And so a lot of the traditional expenses you have with operating a startup, like customer support, you know, I'm sure Coinbase has hundreds of customer support people, or things like, you know, ton of operational stuff. If you're building something on the actual protocol layer, you don't need most of that stuff. You just really just need a good engineering team, which means they could, you know, and should actually be relatively lean, with relatively small numbers of people. You know, Ethereum doesn't do everything perfect, but they do have a pretty lean developer team, and they've shipped quite a bit of, you know, in my opinion, world-changing code, mm-hmm. with a relative team. And I think that's something that's admirable, versus, you know, as a new project, you really don't, in my opinion, need to raise $50 million, $100 million, especially if you're primarily focused on, you know, developing a protocol.
Mm. But do you think it's a downside if entrepreneurs have that much money at their disposal?
Yeah, I think there is a downside. So, you know, if you look at kind of history of Silicon Valley, it usually hasn't turned out well when companies raise, you know, enormous sums of money very early on for kind of their first or second rounds. You know, some of the reason is it kind of takes the edge off and keeps you less focused. Even personally, I find that when, you know, most of my money is invested in other projects, and I don't really have any money sitting around, I'm much more kind of sharp-edged, focused, about working on things than I am if I have money just sitting in my bank account doing nothing. And I think the same is for people, you know, operating companies. If you're a startup and you have, you know, $40 million sitting in the bank, or if you're operating a startup and you have, you know, maybe $3 million sitting in the bank, and that's enough to get you through the next 18 months, it really makes you think differently. There's both downsides and upsides to it. But I think the way, you know, funding has worked in the past, where you kind of do smaller rounds of funding and then do subsequently larger ones, actually makes more sense, because it keeps you on edge, versus if you have a large capital up front and you really kind of lose that edge, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on there. I mean, how did you guys deal with that at Augur? I mean, because you also raised quite a lot of money. And how did you guys make sure that you stayed on mission?
Yeah. So for Augur, we raised about $5 million. And what we did is we...
Yeah, but it was in Ether, right? So the Ether price went up quite a bit, I guess.
Yeah. So what we did is we sold 90% of it for cash and kept 10% of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So the idea behind that being that if you look at Ethereum, they actually almost ran out of money at one point because they didn't sell any of their crypto.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And so we wanted to kind of keep things safer. And I think the way to think about it is, you know, I was bullish on Ether at the time, but, you know, when creating kind of a open source software foundation, you shouldn't really kind of bet with the money like that. It should be more like the money's meant for the software development. And you shouldn't kind of, you know, run a hedge fund with the money you raised from people, right? And so what we did is we sold 90% of it, kept 10% of it. And in terms of, you know, dealing with the money, it's really just mostly all been on software development, some expenses for, you know, legal work and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So you paid people in dollars, not in Ether.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Interesting. I didn't know that. How important is location for you when you invest?
Yeah, it's not super important, especially particularly so in the blockchain space. You know, if you're like doing, say, a biotech startup, mm-hmm. you know, Boston or San Diego is kind of the place to be. But if you're doing something in the blockchain space, it really is pretty distributed. Of the deals we see at Pantera, you know, maybe 50 to 60% are based in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
The other 40%, though, are kind of all across the globe. And some of our most successful investments have actually been overseas. So it's not like, you know, Silicon Valley, where every unicorn kind of comes out of there and it's hard to find good startups other places. Opposite, there's lots of good ones overseas in this space.
Mm-hmm. But for Pantera, does it make most sense to be in Silicon Valley?
You know, I think for like our firm, you mean?
I mean, you mentioned before 50% of your investment or your portfolio companies are also in Silicon Valley. But I wonder whether, you know, you could have a fund maybe in London or in Tel Aviv that also has that kind of deal flow or that also has access. So I'm wondering whether you're maybe uniquely positioned if you have your fund also in Silicon Valley and then invest in these companies, or whether location is perhaps less important in this space.
Oh, got it. Yeah, that's a good question. So I think you still have an advantage being based in Silicon Valley. And the primary reason I say that is a lot of the overseas projects still visit Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the projects we invest in and find out about are projects who, you know, email us and say, hey, we're visiting Silicon Valley. You're looking to meet with potential investors, and we'd love to set up a meeting with you guys. And if we lived in, you know, say Singapore or something, I don't know if that would be the case. Like, I don't know if projects, you know, go around to those other cities. Like, I imagine London is probably similar. Like, a good amount of projects are probably in London at some point. But if you start, you know, picking kind of like, as you start going kind of down the list of cities, then it becomes harder. Like, for instance, you know, most projects probably don't stop through, say, Denver during their fundraising process.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm currently in Switzerland, in Zurich, and there are lots of projects stopping, you know, coming through here, but there's not that many that actually operate out of this place. And I mean, currently, there is this big debate, you know, with investment funds, what is a good jurisdiction in Europe? And many of them look at Malta or Gibraltar, and Switzerland has kind of, you know, lost out on as a location for the investment funds. So for you with Pantera, how did you decide on where to locate the fund and where to locate the investment company?
Yeah, so Pantera was started actually a while ago. It started originally in 2003. By Dan Moorhead, who's CEO of the firm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he started it on the West Coast. And, you know, that's kind of unorthodox because most hedge funds are based on the East Coast. But, you know, when we started doing crypto investments, which he's kind of pivoted the entire firm to focus solely on cryptocurrency and blockchain tech in 2013, you know, the firm just stayed in the Bay Area. And it was actually kind of a more natural fit for that because of the fact that, you know, there's lots of tech in this area.
So if somebody has a startup or wants you to invest in his or her startup, what should they do?
Yeah. So it's a common question we get, and, you know, people think it's a really kind of complicated process, and it is kind of a black box for most VCs, like their process of evaluating deals and things like that. But for Pantera, it's pretty straightforward. You just, you know, email somebody at the firm, whether it's, you know, myself or one of the other partners, and our emails are just our first name at panteracapital.com. And then we go from there. Basically, the most useful thing is to send over, you know, some useful information about your project, whether it's a deck or a paper or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. How many submissions like these do you get usually?
It depends on the day, but, you know, definitely get like dozens of them a week.
Joey, since when have you been investing in companies?
So I first started in like, you know, not that long ago. So the way I got started was, there is this company called Numerai that I wanted to invest in. Mm-hmm. One of my friends and I wanted to invest in, and, it was like early 2016. And I'm specifically talking about startups. I always used to invest in you know, public markets and stocks and stuff for fun, but for startups in particular, so we saw this company we wanted to invest into. We didn't have a ton of money, and kind of the minimum check size was, you know, around 500 grand. And so what we ended up doing is spun up an angelist syndicate, which kind of still exists. I do some non-blockchain deals through it. And what we did is we basically, you know, raise funds from people we knew, people who were interested in the deal, people who wanted to invest but couldn't meet the minimum, and that's kind of how I got started.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn these skills? You know, to set up this fund and, you know, to talk to investors, to look at the investments. How did you learn all this?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of it is something that you're kind of, you know, always learning more, but. A lot of it I learned from, you know, reading. There's a lot of good blog posts on investing, mm-hmm. From investors. And there's also, you know, a few good books on it as well. And then a lot of it, though, is really just, you know, kind of doing it. You know, when we first started, you know, doing angel investing in projects like Numerai, I think the quickest thing to do is really to just kind of dive in and try to do it. For that, you know, deal, I was actually surprised that we were able to raise the capital to invest in the deal, given that I didn't really, you know anybody in the investment community at the time. Mm-hmm. And then after that one, I ended up syndicating 0x, the decentralized exchange. And then the syndicate kind of grew really fast from there because that deal was a really good one.
I read somewhere, I think it may have also been on AngelList, that you said that you like companies with competition, but where the competition has no chance. So how do you go about analyzing the competition?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think the way I think about it is you want some really kind of almost unfair competitive advantage. So I mean, the best example I can think of off the top of my head for this is like, you know, if somebody were to start a company on top of Augur that was basically a betting site. And if you look at, you know, sites like Betfair or Paddy Power, there's this thing in sports betting called the payout ratio. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially for every, you know, dollar that's bet, how much does the person get back on average after fees and things like that? And on those sites, it's about 92%. So for a business like that built on top of Augur, the fees on Augur are usually sub 1%. So that's the spread between those two is around 7%, or you're roughly, you know, 7 to 8x cheaper than your competition. And so that would be something that I consider, you know, an unfair competitive advantage, where if someone were to build a business like this and actually spin it up, it would be really hard for kind of the legacy players to compete, because of the fact that if they were to try to drop their fees to match you, they just wouldn't be able to operate anymore. It'd make them go bankrupt. So like, that's kind of one example. Mm-hmm. A good example that actually exists in the real world is, you know, something like Amazon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Amazon has lots of competition, but they really just can't compete on the margins or on the fees, because Amazon's able to charge such lower prices for things.
I mean, you mentioned before legacy players. So what do you think will happen to, you know, today's maybe Fortune 500 companies with all this blockchain innovation coming up?
Yeah. So one really interesting thing I saw about actually the S&P 500 was that the average lifetime of a company in the S&P before it, you know, gets removed, whether that's due to, you know, acquisition, bankruptcy, or just being removed from the list because it's not in the top 500 anymore, it's decreasing. So it's actually shorter than it's ever been in any other history. I think it's something like 6 years, but I'm not 100% on that.
Okay.
So when I think of, you know, legacy players, it's really just, you know, if you're someone who, some company who has a really kind of good position in the industry, yet you kind of have an old way of doing things, and you're not really looking down kind of the curve of sort of what sort of innovations you can use to make your business better. Mm-hmm. And the kind of risk is, it's just a classic kind of innovator's dilemma, where if you eventually just don't do anything, eventually someone else is going to execute on using new tech to make your business better. And by the time you realize it, it might just be too late. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the thing I think about. So when it comes to blockchain tech, there's a lot of players in the financial system today. A lot of them will not be disrupted by blockchain tech. A lot of them will. Some of them, I think, will, you know, figure it out and evolve with the tech. And then some of them, I think, will just be left behind. And if you look at the kind of financial sector, it's one of the largest sectors of the economy. You have, you know, government itself, healthcare, finance, and those are basically the top three sectors in the economy. Hmm. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens as the financial system is transformed by this tech.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll still have banks in 10 years' time?
Yeah, I still think we'll have banks. I think they'll look a bit different. You know, I think they'll look much more online focused. Mm-hmm. If you look at banking today, I hate going to the bank, to be honest. I hate what if I ever have to write out a check. ACH, electronic transfers, are pretty great because you just put in the information and then you transfer, and then it happens, you know, either same day or some cases 3 days from then. But checks, I don't like them at all, and I hate actually going to the physical bank. And I think that's true for a lot of millennials and kind of the next generations upcoming are going to have similar thoughts along those lines. And so I think from the banking standpoint, it still makes sense to have banks for some things. Like for instance, mortgage loans for houses. I don't foresee those really getting tokenized and tradable on blockchains super soon, because of the fact that they're kind of a product that a lot of retail investors wouldn't really want to buy. If you pitched, you know, the average consumer in the US on, hey, you can invest in this thing that's has a 3% yield, it's relatively safe, but it's, you know, you get 3% a year. Most people probably want to invest in it because it's this huge kind of search for yield today. And so I think sorts of things like instruments like that will still exist at banks, just because the kind of, you don't gain that much from disintermediating them. You know, maybe your mortgage goes down from 3% to 2.5% or something if you have a peer-to-peer version of it. It's super liquid. But there's other areas of the financial markets that I think will be disintermediated. Things like, you know, correspondent banking, where you're routing payments to another bank. There's a handful of banks globally that make a large amount of fees off that service, and the other banks will often pay for it. There's no reason that kind of be disintermediated by, you know, some shared ledger.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own, the Blockchain and Us newsletter.
get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. Are you in touch with, you know, the big tech companies, like, for example, Amazon, you mentioned before, or Google, Apple, Facebook? I mean, do you talk to these guys about how they use blockchain, or do you see what's going on there?
Yes, I know it. I know individual employees at them. You know, I don't really talk to, you know, the companies themselves on like any formal basis or anything.
But how are they using blockchains and, you know, tokens and all that?
Yeah, so a lot of companies are just, you're really just starting to look at it. You know, even if you look at a company like Google, which is generally considered to be pretty innovative, and as Sergey Brin said recently at a conference, that they've kind of, you know, missed the blockchain wave so far and haven't really done that much with it, but they're starting to look into it through Google X, which is just kind of interesting. If you look at Facebook, they're doing some stuff by trying to create, you know, some sort of token. There's been a few, you know, media releases about that. I think it's all pretty early there, but I think they're finally kind of starting to dive in and see what it's all about. Mm-hmm.
What, in your view, what do you think is the probability that they either already have missed the boat or will miss the boat in the near future on this technology?
Yeah. So the way I think about it is, I guess the simplest way to explain it is like the next thing never looks like the last thing. And it's a super simple concept, right? It's like when Apple created the PC, it didn't look like anything like the, you know, previous IBM mainframes that were super popular. Mm-hmm. You know, before Apple, IBM ruled the computing world, and now they're, you know, they still exist, but they're not nearly as relevant as they used to be. And I think if you look at, you know, blockchain tech, there's a lot of stuff where it doesn't really make sense for kind of traditional players to use it. And so like, if you look at something like Ethereum, you know, it wouldn't have really made sense for say Google or Facebook to have created Ethereum. For one, it'd be kind of a really weird product, different than all the other products, because it doesn't really try to extract value from data, which is their main business model. And then two, it you know, looks pretty different. It's something that they wouldn't actually control, which again is really, really, very different. And so I think if you look at this tech, a lot of the things that it does and a lot of the ways that it works is very kind of antithetical or the antithesis of regular companies. And I think it's hard for, you know, one of these companies to even per se get in the boat, because the boat's not a boat. Like it's just so different than anything else that doesn't always make sense for them to jump in. Mm-hmm.
So, but again, I mean, do you think... there's a probability that they might not be around in a few years?
So I think they'll still be around. You know, I think if you look at companies like, you know, Facebook, Google, et cetera, they're really good at, they definitely have transformed, you know, the way information works in society. And if you look at blockchain tech, you know, I personally, there's tons of people who disagree with me on this, but I personally don't think it's going to transform information that much. I think it's going to transform much more value, finance, derivatives, things like that. And those are areas that, for the most part, you know, with a few exceptions, companies like Facebook and Google aren't that active in anyway.
Why do you think the information use case doesn't hold up?
So I think, you know, if you look at what the tech's good for and what it will be good for over the next, you know, five to 10 years, it's, you know, even if kind of all the scalability problems are solved to kind of the current satisfaction people have, there's still kind of, you know, one main issue, which is you're still going to run into scalability problems if you try to use it for just transferring information. Like if you're doing financial transactions, like for instance, the amount of trades that you see on the New York Stock Exchange per day are kind of, they pale in comparison to the number of requests that Facebook or Google alone sees per day. And so even if you solve all the problems for financial scalability, you still have a ton for scalability if using the tech for informational usages. And then I think the next thing is just, you know, society itself doesn't necessarily care as much, in my opinion, about their information and how it's used. Like you saw kind of some backlash against Facebook for the Cambridge Analytica stuff. The people have already started to kind of forget about it a bit. And versus, you know, money, people notice if you know, they're getting a 5% higher yield in their bank account, or people notice if something that used to cost them $10 now costs them $5. So it's kind of a simpler, easier use case to get traction, I think. That doesn't mean information stuff can't happen. It just means that I think it's at least if it does happen, it'll be after the financial applications.
Mm. And you said before, you think people maybe just don't care whether somebody uses their data or sells it or mines it in a specific way.
Right.
But do you care about it? I mean, is this a topic that you're very interested in or that's important for you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't like how, I don't like the kind of concept of how just by using the internet day to day, you're essentially being spied on, whether that's by, the NSA or whether that's by, a random service that you're using. And there are some cool projects working on solving this issue. Like there's, Orchid Labs, which is solving this. It is actually a blockchain project, which is pretty interesting. I think from like the general population standpoint, though, they don't necessarily care as much. Like when the kind of NSA data gathering stuff got renewed, I think like maybe sometime this year, maybe a few months ago, or maybe it's in the beginning of the year. I don't remember if they haven't kept up super on it. But if most people cared, you would have expected to see kind of a huge backlash against the congressman who voted for it. Instead, you saw a small amount of people backlash against it. There are some large tech companies, people in Silicon Valley, a few kind of libertarian-esque people who backlashed against it. But you didn't see kind of this huge kind of populist wave of people saying, hey, like, this isn't right. Like, you shouldn't just be collecting all our data, willy-nilly. But nothing really happened. So I think that's why I kind of believe that the average person, at least in the United States, doesn't care about it as much.
Mm. I think not just in the United States, I think everywhere. And it's a problem, because it is going to end up... I mean, I think some people I speak with, they say it's not going to end well, all of this. What Web 2.0 has turned into, it's going to end up with huge problems. And I mean, do you think people should be more sensitive to this issue? Or is it really up to everybody themselves, whether they want to expose themselves to that kind of, let's call it surveillance or, data being used for stuff? Or is it not that much of an issue?
I mean, I think it's an issue. The hard part is getting people to kind of understand it's an issue.
How should that be done? What do you think?
Yeah, that's why I paused. I was thinking, how would you do that? It'd be cool to see like some people do some like kind of almost like artwork or art pieces that exposed it. So like imagine somebody took like Chrome browser and either made a plugin or forked it and added some stuff that told you kind of, it showed you visually like where all your data was going when you visited a site. That might actually make it kind of hit home for people that their data is being harvested and that kind of all their online activity is being, bought and sold on advertising markets, and then also, sent to the government as well. I don't know if that would make people care or not, but at least it would make people aware so that they can make, an informed decision about whether it matters or not to them.
So when you look around, maybe at your peers or just at the world more generally, next to this whole data issue, what do you think needs to improve?
I think it needs, first of all, from a business standpoint, if we go with the thesis that, the average person doesn't care, it'd still be nice at least if, you could pay to opt out of it. So for the people who do care, they could essentially, opt out of this kind of like 1984-esque data collection. Because that's something I'd happily pay, a bit of money each month for. And I think it's just kind of nicer peace of mind. I think it's something where, basically like sites and services that collect all this data should, aim to do a better job at informing the user kind of what sort of trade-offs they're making by using them and better informing them of the fact that their data is being collected. It's all stuff that's kind of, it's sometimes against, or a lot of the time against their, bottom line to do it from like a profit standpoint. But I think it'd make the, internet a lot healthier place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Are there certain things about the future that scare you?
I think the main thing about the future is just it's unknown. So it's hard to know, you know, what you would be afraid of.
unknowns, right?
Yeah, unknown unknowns are the main problem, I guess.
You mentioned the data issue and we talked about it quite at length. But, you know, other than that, and if people don't change or wake up to things, then, you know, there'll be serious issues down the road.
Yeah, so I'm more of I'm a pretty optimist on the future, I think. You have people like, you know, Peter Thiel, who I respect a lot, but he thinks, you know, that technological progress is slowing and the future kind of looks much more dark. Mm-hmm. I actually think the opposite. I think, you know, progress always looks slow when you're in it. But if you look back, you know, 5 years, you look back 10 years, there's been huge amounts of progress that have been made. You look back 10 years ago, the iPhone kind of just came out. You know, it's this really clunky device that everybody hated in the reviews. There's definitely, you know, negative effects of that. Some people are just kind of on their phones playing video games all day. There's also a lot of positive effects of it. It makes it much easier to look something up kind of instantaneously without having to lug a laptop around you all the time. And so I think, you know, when I think about the future, the way I think about tech is, you know, it's basically tech is kind of a tool. And there's, you know, positive uses for tools and there's negative uses for them. And I think like anything else, you know, the question mark is more, you know, do you think the positive will outweigh the negative? And for me, I think it's, you know, for the most part, it's a yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any specific like examples where you saw that tech, you know, improved something massively for people or, you know, enabled them to do things that they couldn't previously do? You know, that kind of touched you personally, you know, beyond just a rational thing where you say, oh, everything becomes more efficient, but, you know, maybe just a more tangible example.
You know, for instance, with if you look at something like, you know, the internet in general, you know, people always talk about how it'd be really cool if, you know, there is information available for free so you could learn about how to do things online. And a concrete example of this is, you know, there was some kid who was, I think, you know, 13 or 14, who made a contribution to the Opera code base. He added support for Trezor wallets.
Cool.
And he did it without even owning a Trezor. We shipped him one so he could test it, and there were like one or two bugs that he fixed. And then that's, you know, how Augur now has Trezor wallet support. And so that's pretty cool, where I think, like, you know, I think you live somewhere in kind of the middle of the country somewhere where, you know, 10 years ago, it wouldn't have been possible to teach yourself how to do that sort of stuff, or it would have been extremely difficult. But now, you know, it's cool to see people, somebody as young as that, you know, shipping code into something in production that actually makes a difference. It's cool that people can now use Trezor wallets and Augur. So it's a tiny thing. But I think if you kind of sum all those little tiny things up, that's what I think makes, you know, tech great.
Mm-hmm. Cool. You mentioned Peter Thiel a few times, and I mean, you also were a Thiel fellow in the 20 Under 20 program. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, it's been great. You know, it has a really nice community of people who are all kind of working on interesting problems, both, you know, in tech and some of them outside of tech.
You mentioned before the example with the Trezor wallet, and that's obviously not something that you could have learned at a university, how to do that. So how can universities justify their existence in the future?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I didn't mention it at the beginning, but another one of those areas like healthcare and finance and government that's ripe for disruption is also education. It's another one of those few kind of areas of the economy where the cost of it is just so high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think universities are still relevant in some cases. Like, there's lots of stuff that you can learn online, especially like computer science stuff or history or things like that. There's some stuff that's much harder though. Like if you wanted to, you know, learn chemistry, there's a lot of stuff that having an actual access to an actual lab, does benefit you quite a bit. It makes things more concrete. You can kind of touch them. You can figure out things besides just reading a textbook. And so I think there are areas where, you know, it's hard to get access to a lab unless you're at, you know, university or college. But I think in general, the kind of cost of school isn't really worth the value that you get, in my opinion. It's, at least in the US, it's definitely, universities cheap, much cheaper, in other countries. But in the United States, you know, if you're paying, $60,000 a year to go to university, you know, one simple way to kind of do the calculus is to think, well, assuming you have somebody, like, whether it's your kid or, you know, whatever, who's interested in able to kind of learn on their own through the internet. Like, if you ask, you know, them, would you rather have, you know, this money just put into stocks or you can learn on your own, or you go to university and, you know, all the money's gone. From a super rational standpoint, you know, I think the stocks one makes more sense. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're the type of person who is able to learn, on your own. And so I think that, you know, the cost/value perspective of university is off right now.
Are you still in touch with Peter Thiel on a like regular basis?
You know, not super regularly. You know, he's a busy guy.
What do you think? I mean, I'm going to ask a question out of 0 to 1, because I really liked it. One thing that he asks startup entrepreneurs usually, where he said, what is a thing that many people working in the space that, you know, the entrepreneur focuses on believe will turn out to be wrong? And, you know, if we look at that, you know, in relation to blockchain and crypto technology, then what do you think many people working in this space, you know, on cryptocurrencies or in blockchain technology, what they accept as true, what do you believe will turn out to be wrong in the medium or long term?
Yeah, I love that question, because it gives the insight into, you know, how somebody thinks. And I think for me, the answer to that would be, maybe it's a little too meta, but I think the way I think about it is, people in the space kind of have a tendency to really want things to be really kind of rigorously proven from like a theoretical standpoint. And I think what's interesting about this space is, I think there are lots of things in the space that will work in practice that do not and will not work in theory. I think Bitcoin is actually an example of one of those. If you look at Bitcoin, technically speaking, it's vulnerable to selfish mining attacks. And if you had, you know, kind of a committee of game theory experts decide whether to sign off on releasing Bitcoin or not, they probably would not have released it because it was vulnerable to those attacks. But in practice, you know, it seems to work. And so I think that's kind of one thing that's I believe.
What do you think maybe non-technical people, perhaps those with more of a passing knowledge of cryptocurrencies or blockchain technology, what do you think they should understand better about what this technology can do?
Yeah, so I think the main thing to understand would be, you know, I guess there's kind of two things. One is, you know, I think even if you don't understand the tech, you should read a little bit about it to try to kind of wrap your head around how it works, at least kind of at a level of like analogies, for instance. Mm-hmm. I think that's really useful. From a non-technical standpoint, you know, I think the way I think about it is, what this tech enables is kind of like, if you look at the world, you know, before the printing press, it was really hard to create new books. If you wanted to author a book or disseminate a book around the world, it was very difficult. You had to have, you know, monks and scribes write it down and copy it. Mm-hmm. After the printing press, it was very easy. And I think if you look at this tech, it's going to do something similar for finance. So I think the financial markets are kind of in the pre-printing press world, where if you wanted to create a new financial market on something, you'd have to call up a bank like Goldman or call, you know, Morgan Stanley, and, you know, pay them a few million dollars to write some custom contract, which you then enter into with another party. Hopefully you can find someone who's willing to take the other side. And I think post kind of blockchain world, you fast forward a few years from now, I think that's going to be a thing that will be much easier and much cheaper to do using blockchain tech. And so just like how if you wanted to make a book after the printing press came out, it was very easy. I think the same thing will be true for financial markets in a post-blockchain world.
Do you think you'll still be working on blockchain technology in maybe 10 years?
Yeah, I think so. Or, you know, at least I'll still be involved with it. It depends how the you know, healthcare stuff that we talked about earlier progressed. Maybe I'll be onto that by then. But I think it's something that I think, you know, it's going to take a full 10 to 20 years for all this stuff to play out. And so it's something that I think I'll continue to be excited about, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. In your projects, in your own projects, or also in your work at Pantera, who are your role models?
Yeah, so I think, you know, from a kind of financial standpoint, or like an investing standpoint, you know, some of those are kind of, you know, cliche people like Warren Buffett, I think, is a great role model for kind of long-term investing. For kind of more short-term stuff, I'm really a fan of Jim Simons from Renaissance Technologies. And then from a, you know, from a startup standpoint, you know, I also really like Steve Jobs, you know, even though he was not a nice person in general. I loved his sense for design.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that's really important, is kind of having an almost obsessive focus over the design and usability of products. Because that's how I think, that's kind of the big differentiator, I think. You know, if you give people two products that mathematically in the background are the same, and one of them has a better user experience, people will choose the one with the better user experience, you know, almost every time. And so I think that's something that's really important.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You mentioned user experience a few times. And is this the main thing that you think should improve in blockchain applications? Or are there other things that you think should improve in the coming years?
Yeah, I think mainly user experience, because everything else kind of fits under that bucket. So if you look at like scalability, it's a technical challenge, and if you have faster blockchains, you have better experience from the user standpoint, because you can do things quicker. You look at like the problem of, you know, getting fiat currency into crypto. That's another problem, but it also kind of is a subset of the user experience issues. So yeah, I think that's the number one mm-hmm. issue is user experience, kind of from all different angles.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. If somebody wanted to get started, you know, with blockchain technology, working in this field or working with cryptocurrencies, where do you think should they start?
Yeah, so I think you know, the best place to start, I would say, is, you know, read the Bitcoin white paper. If you're completely new to it, a lot of it won't make sense, but read it again, and then Google some of the stuff that the terms that you don't understand or the things that don't make sense in it. And then read, you know, about those. And then after that, you know, I think the next kind of most important individual piece of literature would be probably the Ethereum white paper, because it kind of takes the idea of Bitcoin a bit farther and says, you know, what if instead of letting people send money around, we also let them control the money programmatically? So basically adding the idea of, you know, financial contracts onto money. And then after that, you know, really it's just kind of those things that you just read, you know, what parts of it interest you, and really kind of jumping off from there, I think, is the best way to get started. Also, from a practical standpoint, you know, buy $50 worth of Bitcoin or Ether or something and send it around, and send five of it to your friend or something. And that will help you kind of at least figure out from a user standpoint how it works.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Keep learning,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you yourself learning to do better at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in learning more about, right now, learning more about like state channels. So this idea of, you know, processing transactions off-chain and settling them on-chain. and also just learning more about kind of all the different avenues that are for this tech to scale, are two areas I'm interested in.
Okay, cool. If you had a wish, you know, to change one thing in your life or in the world, what would that be?
Yeah, so one thing, yeah, if I could only change one thing, I think it would be fast forward like 30 years in the future. I think it would be what I would do. Is kind of fast forward like the technological timeline 30 years ahead. Assuming that, you know, if my bullish view of the tech future is right, then that will be a good thing. If it's more kind of a pessimistic view, that might end up being a bad thing. But that's kind of the bet I would make, is that by doing that, I could probably, it'd probably be affect more change than kind of any other individual wish I could do, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. You'll be 53 then, though. Not sure that's so desirable. Are you often thinking about what you'll do in, you know, when you're 40 or 50 years old?
Not a whole lot. You know, I'm really just thinking about what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years and think about that. And then, you know, once that happens, then I'll get to that point when I get there, sort of thing.
So, where can people find you, Joey?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter username is just @JoeyKrug. Or if you want to, you know, shoot me an email, my email is joeykrug@gmail.com.
Yeah, this was really fascinating. And thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking time today.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guest and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.